the people who led and like worked on Skunk Works such had such an intuitive understanding of the aircraft that they were building. A lot of it from experience and like doing it over and over again and just being obsessed with the craft. That, you know, I want people like that on my team. Mm-hmm. And I want people who are so excited about what we're building that they come back after dinner. They go have dinner, they do whatever they need to do for like an hour or two, and then they come back to the office and they're here like working on something because they just want to solve it.
Hello, I'm Ty. Welcome to Relentless. This is my conversation with Soren Monroe Anderson, the co-founder of Neuros. I hope you enjoy the conversation. So you talked about being able to visualize like 3D models in your head really well. When was the first time you like tried to design a boat or a plane?
I don't think I can remember the first time because that was just like all I did. Like my after school activity in Anchorage was like taking a notepad and like graph paper and then like sketching out like the internal tubing of like a bush plane or like the outline of the hull of the boat I was thinking about. And so I would go to the bookstore, library, whatever, and find these books that would talk about like how boats are designed, how planes are designed. And I think like that overall mechanical system, vehicle system, like design thinking is so interesting to me. And I loved like just going and looking at the planes. And that was like one of my favorite activities that like, my mom would take me to this, place called Merrill Field in Anchorage. It's like not the big airport, but it's a small airport, actually close to downtown where all the bush planes fly in. And we would go and just like, at that point you could just go in and like walk around the planes and just like drive up to everything. So that was like, I think I would probably was like 6-7 years old when we'd do that. And yeah, it's just like core memory.
What initially like turned you on to going to the library and like picking up those books?
I think it was just natural interest. Like,
just natural interest.
It was just the stuff I thought was super cool. I think there was there isn't one thing I can think of that made me want to do it, but it's just always the inclination I had.
I think you designed a hang glider when you were like 8 or 9 or 10. What's the story behind that? And did you ever end up building it?
I think that was like 8 years old. Mm-hmm. I didn't end up building it. That one my parents did veto in terms of like building it and then trying to flying it. But I did go and visited a couple different shops that had different materials for tubing. And I was looking for a certain type of either very light aluminum or carbon fiber tubing that would be like long enough and stiff enough for that like front spar in the hang glider. So we did actually, like my parents took me to a couple different places to look at the materials for what would go into that. So it was something I thought about a lot, and it tied into all of my other like dream designs of like things that would allow me to fly. A lot of things in that category. Yeah.
Did you design anything else other than a hang glider?
Yeah. I mean, countless things. I was pretty obsessed with the kind of like Iron Man or jetpack idea, as many people were, but like I went pretty deep on it. So I think in my old notebooks, there's hundreds of designs, just sketches, right? They're not like incredibly in depth, but so many sketches of different ideas on like how I could make a winged vehicle that would be like a personal vehicle for me to fly on. And I remember there's this one animated movie, I don't remember which one it is now. Let me think. Who's the studio that does like Howl's Moving Castle and like...
Is it Pixar?
No. It's a Japanese studio.
Oh, I wouldn't know.
I'm blanking on the name, but I remember there's this one movie and the main character in that animated movie has this little like wing that she can stand on. It's just like a wing. It's like 15 feet long. It's got like these two handles and she just stands on it and she like fly around. And that, like, I wanted to build that. That was like the dream.
Yeah. Did you, so you said that you like initially started thinking about starting companies when you were like 8 or 9, I think, or maybe even earlier. What was the first idea you had? Was it just one of your designs or something else?
I don't know. Again, I'm bad at like knowing exactly which year it was. Like it could have been, you know, like 8 to 10, maybe even earlier. But I, when my dad married my stepmom at their wedding, which was on the East Coast, we'd gone to Vermont for their wedding. There were these, it was like a gravel driveway, mm-hmm. but like every 100 rocks was like a pretty, like I thought like pretty interesting, like quartz crystal. So I went down the whole driveway and I picked out all the like really cool rocks. And then I set up a booth in the garage in the house where they were getting married on their wedding night that said like crystals for sale. And I waited till everyone had like a few drinks and then I started spinning this up and like calling people over, and I think it was like $1 a rock, and I made maybe like $40, which at the time was like, that was so much money. And yeah, I remember that as a very core memory of like, wow, I can just like find something and sell it to people. So I've always been doing things like that, but that one sticks out.
I think around the same time you designed a like hovercraft made out of plywood. What mm-hmm. is the story behind that?
That was a little later on. Yeah. Okay. So this was a kind of like a classic YouTube project, but I don't think that many people ended up actually building it. But you could basically take a piece of plywood, cut it into a circle that's like 6 feet in diameter, and then take a leaf blower. And the way a hovercraft works is you have this sort of bag of inflated air that then has these holes. And so you inflate the bag with a source of airflow, and then that comes out of the holes on the bottom and creates this like cushion of air that you can basically ride on. And so it's this very low friction way of moving a vehicle. So it took a leaf blower, made this bag under the piece of plywood, leaf blower hole in the top of the plywood. Pretty simple system, but you could actually make a very functional hovercraft that I could ride around on in the driveway. And the next version of that was like making, you know, adding some type of propulsion, because that would just mm-hmm. get you the hovercraft effect. And you need to like be pushed around by something, that you could also add propulsion to it. So it was super fun. And I remember that thing fondly because it was my, I guess it would have had to be 5th or 6th grade, because it was my mm-hmm. like science fair project at the school I was at that point.
Yeah. And you also mentioned that you like, so this must be the same leaf blower, but you said that you increased the runtime by double on the leaf blower. How did yeah. you do that?
Not if you're looking at actual like energy efficiency, yeah, I yeah. didn't, but it was a great project. So I made a hydrogen generator, where you use electrolysis to split apart water molecules and get the hydrogen and oxygen gas out. And looking back now, this is like a very powerful hydrogen generator. I was like, well, what happens if I plug that into the leaf blower engine that I have and then start leaning out the fuel mixture on the carburetor? And I could get like from a basically just the fuel that was left in the line was my way of measuring. I'd like fill the line that goes into the gas tank. So it would normally run for like 50 seconds off the fuel in the line, ran for minute 40. If I had the hydrogen gas from the generator also going into the engine. And then I was seeing like how much more power, top end power I could get with full mixture and the hydrogen and oxygen going into the carburetor. So that was really, really cool. I love stuff like that, and especially as a kid making bottle rockets. And I made a little torch off of that hydrogen generator. So
you said you made bottle rockets. How many did you make, and how many like tests did you run?
Many, but you could take a water bottle like uh-huh. this, and then you put it in a bucket of water, and then you take the tube from the hydrogen generator and you stick the tube into the bottle that's full of water, but then the gas displaces the water and it goes down, and then it is filled with hydrogen, and then you cap it off underwater, and then you have this bottle that's filled with hydrogen and oxygen. So then you just take the cap off and put a lighter to it, and
it just fires off.
Yeah. So we did a bunch of those. Also fired off many model rockets, rocket engines without rockets around them. Like me and my best friend David, who probably will come up a lot in this, we would take model rocket engines or gunpowder or whatever we were playing with, put it in a PVC pipe, and then use a igniter, like a electric igniter, and shoot them off, and they would just like go so fast out of the end of this pipe. Things were launched.
Who was buying you gunpowder?
My dad.
Your dad. So yeah. Has he just been like extremely supportive?
Yeah, I think my parents are incredible in the way they've like let me explore my natural interests as a kid. Very supportive, and like they would do their best to make sure everything was happening safely.
But they let it happen.
But they let it happen. Yeah.
They let it happen.
Yeah.
So maybe this actually kind of goes from the hang glider. Did you like try to build a hang glider and then your parents kind of stopped that? Is this when they like gave you an RC plane? When was that?
I think I was already doing RC planes.
Okay.
They didn't really actively stop the hang glider, but they were like, I think I probably, if I really pushed, I could maybe have built it. But my mom was like, you're not going to run off a cliff with this thing. Like, you're 10 years old and you're not going to do that. And so that kind of killed the hang glider idea for me. But yeah, I was flying RC airplanes then. And just a couple years later is when I would find FPV and kind of get the feeling of flying, but from while sitting on the ground. And obviously it's a lot safer. So these things all tie into each other for sure.
Your dad like runs this mapping company, and is he trying to like catch video or images, or what did he try to do? Because he buys you a Phantom One,
mm-hmm.
and then you ended up throwing a Fat Shark.
Correct.
On it.
Yeah.
What was that process of him deciding to buy a Phantom One and then you starting to use it?
Yeah, so his business focused a lot on like street level data. Mm-hmm. He kind of had street level data of places before anyone had this stuff. And he started before high resolution satellite imagery was a thing, mm-hmm. or before it was widespread at least. And so he got very interested in the early days of like drone imagery. You know, you can create a 3D image by taking many pictures of like a building around with a drone, and those are all GPS tagged, and then you can stitch them together, right? So we were exploring different ways of doing that. We had like a 3D Robotics, which is one of the original drone companies in the US, had a few 3D Robotics drones, and I was kind of tinkering on them, flying them for the company. We also grabbed a Phantom One, because that's what we started with, was like a Phantom One and a GoPro, just taking aerial photos. And then that kind of became like my thing that I was flying all the time, put a FPV system on it. The original Fat Shark system, which was like the gray Dominator goggles and the old camera and video transmitter, I just like literally Velcroed them to the Phantom. It was so fun. It was like the most fun thing ever. Because in RC planes, it was 90% of the time was spent on the ground. So we were like building these things. We'd go out to fly. Something wouldn't work, which is also super valuable. Like that was probably the biggest learning experience. But the Phantom was a product that almost always worked. And the Fat Shark system was pretty reliable. And so I could just like take this out to the beach, to the park, to wherever, and just always be flying. And that kind of changed the game. And so I just remember like, and it had pretty good battery life too. So it was just like a couple batteries, go out wherever and start flying. And it was so much fun. And then I was trying to push it really hard, like a racing drone. And it's all auto level, and you can't fly a Phantom like a racing drone. And that's when the point where we're like, okay, I need to figure out how to build the racing drone and get those parts. And that's where everything started.
What happened? Because I know that you like actually crashed the Phantom One a few times.
Totally.
What happened when that happened the first time?
I think I just hit a couple, like I would like nick trees and stuff because I was trying to go around them too fast and break some propellers. And I think it held up really well for a long time. Mm-hmm. And then I'm, you know, moved on to the racing drones.
Yeah. So you, I think, moved to Vermont when you were like 12,
mm-hmm.
right? Okay. What was it like when you moved? And I guess your dad had like a field out front. Were you just, did you just start training immediately? Or what was that transition?
Yeah, so we moved to New Hampshire, but right next to Vermont. I kind of use them interchangeably, similar area. We moved to New Hampshire when I was 12, and that is when I was starting to get really into FPV, but I wasn't yet super serious about racing. And it was like a little too young to kind of like put all the pieces together to be super competitive. but I was getting there. And then around that time is when I started going to bigger events. So I think like in 2016, that was when I went to the first race and I was like, wow, there are people who are
really fucking
really
good.
Yeah. And like really put in the hours. And then that just kind of got reinforced 2017, where I actually met Olaf, my co-founder, the big multi-GP event, International Open. I met him. I met a ton of really cool people, people I'd seen online that were like the best pilots in the world. And I remember hanging out in a room at the hotel with some like the best pilots in the world. It was just like the most fun. And that's when I knew like I wanted to do this. I saw kind of what you had to put into it to be at that level. And looking back now, it's funny because those pilots were actually not at that high of a level compared to where people are now, right? Like now it's much more serious. But it was the start. It was the start of competitive drone racing.
What do you think the I remember you talking about people used to be really good at like just racing, and some of them were not as good at like freestyling or whatever that was called.
Yeah.
When did that change? When did people, or like what's the difference, and when did that change to people being really good at all disciplines?
I think it's still the case that some people are, you know, really good racing pilots and not that good of a freestyle pilot, but freestyle is very subjective. And I don't think I was ever like an amazing freestyle pilot, but I think it was okay. And then there's freestyle and then there's filming as well. And some racing pilots are very good at filming, some are not, but I think a lot of it just also comes down to practice, right? And you really see these different styles in freestyle, and in filming, but a lot of that is like, you know, can you keep the subject in the shot? Can you tell the story in the proper way? Can you translate what like a director or whoever is saying to you to like translate that into the right shot from the drone? So there's these totally different skill sets between racing, freestyle, filming. I will say though, like the precision that you learn in racing and also the operating under pressure, I think that's why a lot of the professional pilots who raced on the, you know, like on DRL and the really like high circuits, like they went on to do filming and do it well, I think for that reason.
Yeah, can you talk about the, because I know that you had this race when, I guess in 2016, you go to this race in Virginia and you realize how much better people actually are. Mm-hmm. And then you come home and you just start immediately, like, I believe just immediately start training really hard for the next like 6 months or more.
Yeah, I think 2016 was the realization of, wow, people are really good at this. And like, this is what I have to do. 2017 after, I think, yeah, 2017 is when I saw like kind of people closer to my age going to nationals and doing really well. And 2017, I believe, is the year. Yeah, 2017 is when Vanover won MultiGP Nationals. He was pretty young. Olaf was there. So I didn't go to the Reno Nationals because I didn't qualify in 2017. And that like that was just watching that happen online and not being there was what really motivated me. So I went from not qualifying for Nationals to then in 2018 getting third at Nationals. So I think that was probably when I flew. That was one of the periods where I just flew the most and I just got really serious about it. And then from 2017, 2018, 2019, it's like 3 years of every day flying as much as I possibly could.
What specific like training regimen did you have during those years? What were you doing? What were you not doing? Like, how did you break up your time?
Mm-hmm. I think I was not doing as much school as some people would have liked me to be. I remember pretty distinctly before this big race. So there's this race in 2019 in New Jersey, IDRLC, that had the biggest prize pool of like any drone race since Dubai, which was the like thing in 2015 that had the $1 million prize pool. I think IDRLC was like 100K or something, but it was a really significant prize pool for drone racing. And I would get up, I think around 6:30 before school, fly at least 10 batteries before school, go. I'd optimize my school schedule so that I would usually get out early. So I'd put all my classes as far like early in the day and then try and just leave. And then I'd leave around like 1, 2 p.m. and then go back and just fly until it was dark. And I did that every day from like January until I think June. January was very hard to fly in Vermont, but you know, as early as I could to June, I think when the race was, and it like paid off. It really paid off. But that was, it was one of the times when I was very, very serious about it. And I was a little bit older than kind of like the earlier racing. And it was very intentional practice. And I think intentional practice is critical compared to just flying. There's a lot of people who have a lot of flight hours, but intentional practice is what you
especially
need.
Like video games, you know, there's lots of people with thousands of hours and very few people that are like genuinely good.
Right.
So I saw that you had maybe four or five different sponsors, like Flight One and Tattoo, and I think like Pyro something.
Pyro Drone?
Yeah, Pyro Drone. How did you get those sponsors?
Yeah, I think I've had a lot of sponsors from a lot of really great companies in FPV. One of the first ones was Team Black Sheep. Back in 2018, I think when I just kind of started doing well, and I'd been using Team Black Sheep products for a long time, and I had some friends who were on the team, and I think they recommended me, and I got on that. I was so excited because that was a really good, really cool sponsorship with a company I'd known for a long time, and they were like very, very well respected. But it was mostly just about like building the relationships with the companies that I really believed in their products. Like I would never get sponsored by someone that I didn't already fly their thing. And this drone racing is very small, right? So if you're like doing well and you know the people, you'll probably get a sponsorship. And it's just, I always wanted to be representing companies that I could like really stand behind their products. And I was very, very particular about my drone setups. And this is something me and Olaf had in common is like, we really cared about the technology. We really cared about like every last gram on our builds, versus some people just kind of like fly. Like if it works, it works. Right. And that's a fine attitude to have as well. But I think the gear has always been extremely important to me.
So you actually even talked about some people having like effectively racing dads that would just build their own, you know, build their kids' drone for them. But I talked with Olaf last night and he said that you guys built probably hundreds of drones, maybe as many as that, before you actually built Neuros or started Neuros. So what was your process of iteration through building those drones?
Yeah, it's certainly in the hundreds. Like every year the gear would change, people would be trying new things. There was different types of drones that we'd have to build. You know, we had our like 5-inch is kind of the standard racing class prop size. 5-inch is what most people use in sort of open class racing. Now looking at them, they feel really small, but they're like ridiculous power to weight ratio. Everything's kind of been optimized around 5-inch, but we also had bigger stuff in different leagues like DCL, where everyone had these specs, like tighter specs that they had to work around. And we were thinking about how we could get better performance out of these bigger drones. And it was very different like flying styles as well, because momentum matters a lot more. And I really enjoy that flying style too. I think like the DCL and the DRL drones, where they're bigger.
Those? What's the difference?
DRL and DCL. Mm-hmm. So DCL is Drone Champions League, and okay. That was, it's still going. Mostly they do simulator races now, but they did a bunch of European events. And then DRL is the Drone Racing League, which had all the like stadium type events. And that there's like 12 pilots for a season. It was on NBC and kind of the bigger channels. And they would just bring the drones to the event for you, but you would practice with them and totally different flying style than 5-inch open class. Mm-hmm. But just through 5-inch open class, like me and Olaf were always debating like what was the best setup. We usually had very similar things, but we're like, no, mine's better, or you can do it this way. You can remove this and drop 5 grams. So it total iteration process and super, super fun.
You also had actually two different YouTube channels, but I watched pretty much all of the videos of, you know, you created a bunch of drone shot videos or like, anyway, drone flying videos. I know that you were like initially thinking about potentially working for someone like Red Bull or ESPN for like drone flying and like potentially doing content creation.
I think at one point I've liked content creation, and I enjoy the like videography. This was another thing that was kind of doing before I got seriously into drones was mm-hmm. photography and editing and videography. And I would actually go even after we moved from Alaska, I'd go back to this summer camp that had these like amazing photography and videography classes. So that's kind of a passion of mine. But it was really elevated through drone racing because that was the combination of the two things. I did a little bit of filming work, but I never got super into it. I think I was drawn more towards starting companies, and that took more of my time generally. But it was really fun making like YouTube videos. I think it's a great skill to have too.
Yeah, it's especially good for marketing. What were the companies that you, like I know that FPV Supply Co. is on your LinkedIn, but did you have any companies before that that you tried to build?
Yeah, I definitely tried products. Mm-hmm. You know, I had a racing frame, which was super cool to like go through that design process and then figure out how to package it and sell it, distribute it through retailers. I ended up kind of making the decision that I was going to switch over to the frame from this company called 533. Mm-hmm. And like me and Evan had sort of been working on our frames at similar times. And he came out with the Switchback. I came out with my frame. And after a while, I decided to go over to the Switchback. And I thought it was like not quite optimized exactly how I liked it. But 533 was like going off and doing a lot of other components. And I felt like at that point, that was one of the points where I really wanted to focus on being a pilot versus kind of selling the thing. So it was just a choice in focus. But I sold the frame. But I look also outside of drone racing. I looked at a ton of different ideas.
What else did you look at?
So one thing was a pretty fun project to like figure out. It was over it was Christmas break, like 2019, 2020. I was in Costa Rica for 2 weeks, and there was like a lot of fun things to do, but there's also a lot of downtime, and I wanted to get better at CAD. And so I started designing something, and I ended up with carbon fiber, like very minimalistic carbon fiber phone case for an iPhone, because I hated having a case on my phone. So it just like ruins the beauty of this thing.
Yeah.
So the case I designed is like this X that only it like routes to the corners, but when you hold it, your fingers are not interfering with the case at all. And it was the first design was a combination of a carbon fiber plate made in a similar or cut in a similar style to a drone racing frame, and then these machined aluminum corners. And then I went to a fully molded carbon design. But this was an incredibly informative project to learn about like sourcing these parts, you know, the design constraints that you have with like CNC aluminum or molded carbon. And so I ended up going, like, first prototype was the one that was aluminum and carbon, moved to the molded carbon one. Put a lot of, like, you know, I was not that old, and I put like $1,500 that I'd made in drone racing into just buying that mold in really? China. It's like a big steel mold that they make, and that mold could have done thousands of phone cases, probably more, to do that carbon mold, but there's no way to really prototype it besides just buying the mold. And now looking at it, like $1,500 is incredibly cheap for a mold. But that was one of the times where I just like had pretty high conviction, and I just like put money into it. And then I ended up realizing like there was much more useful things to build than phone cases. But that was a really fun one, because I also went through a kind of big branding process of figuring out what I wanted the website to look like, the whole brand guide, the logo, the name, everything. And so that was, and I somehow got this deal where I could work with a very well-known professional branding agency for not very much money. And so I like got this taste of what it's like to actually think about like very deeply how you build a brand. And that was my first foray into that.
Did you have any situations where you got in contact with people that were kind of like high up? Like you said, at this like branding agency or whatever, how did you get in contact with them?
That was just through like mutual friend connections that I started kind of making. They weren't that was just like a really, like those were just like really good professionals, but they were not like, you know, super high status people that were hard to access necessarily, but it was just cool that I got the opportunity to work with folks on that level when I was pretty young. And I didn't have an incredibly strong network of people that just kind of got built out over time. And, you know, I can think about like the connections all the way back very long of like how I met this person and then this person and this person. Now it's like this incredible network of people who I know. So it's kind of fun to trace that back. But for a long time, I didn't like know very many like really important people, I guess.
Yeah. When you were first, I think, was it either 2017 or 2018 when you first like went to nationals? And I think you went to like Europe and you said South Korea.
So after like? After 2018 nationals where okay. I got third, that's when I started racing with Quad Force One, which is basically like Team USA on DCL. And then also got invited to Korea in 2019 with Team USA. So I did a lot of international travel that year. My high school was very unhappy with me. But I went to, I think like 6 different European countries and then South Korea. And it was great. It was amazing. And that was my first foray into a lot of international travel. It was super fun.
Yeah. Who did you look up to at that time?
I think there was pilots who I really respected their level of talent, and like hard work. I think,
is it Danny?
I would say Min Chan.
Okay.
Is just a very, very impressive pilot. He always has been. I mean, he's widely regarded as the best pilot in the world. And you could just like tell his level of performance and control when you saw him fly at these events. And he was at most of the DCL races. And I remember showing up to the first one in 2019 in Switzerland. And it was like Min Chan, Luke Bannister, who is the OG figure in drone racing. Like he won the Dubai race in 2015 and he's been with X-Blades forever. And so it was cool just showing up and like seeing these people that I like already knew who they were. I've been following them since I started flying basically. And then I was competing with them. So that was a very cool feeling.
What happened when you finally decided, like, you know, you finished the phone case, you finished the marketing, and then you decided to work on FPV Supply Co. What was that and how did you start it?
So it started as like a year or two, maybe 2 years before that, two of my friends, Liam and Will, had been selling these pop-up drone racing gates called the Practice Gate. And I thought it was a really cool idea. The Practice Gate, there was a couple like reliability issues with it. And then they like did okay, but they decided not to pursue it. And then it sort of sat in a closet for a long time. Mm. And for some reason, no one like figured out drone racing gates for a long time, in the sense that the DIY stuff was, if you wanted to save a little bit of money, you'd kind of go to Home Depot, you'd put together these PVC pipes, you put like foam or something on the outside of them. It's just like always awful to make an FPV track really well at your house. And the fabric from MultiGP, the really like professional style fabric, was very expensive. And I think the shipping was pretty expensive. And most people didn't just like set up a real fabric course at their house or practice field. And so I just looked at it, I was like, why is this the case? Like, has anyone actually looked at the supply chain? Like, can you make this cheaper? Can you figure out the logistics? So what we did, me and Liam started originally fpvgates.com, which turned into FPV Supply Co. Yep. And we tested a bunch of different materials from Chinese suppliers and also spent a lot of time figuring out how you could package these and send them efficiently. And it turned out that if you put them in you would take 2 poly mailers, because you need the extra strength, but you take 2 poly mailers and you put a roll of gates in them and then you ship them ground. The poly mailers are built differently than boxes. Uh-huh. And ground shipping, great for heavy items. So you could send gates for like $20 on average in the US. And that was much better than what we would usually see on other sites. And so we could do free shipping if someone put in a large enough order. But it was also just about going and searching all of these Chinese suppliers for who would give us a good material at the right cost. So it's just like, why has no one done this yet? It seems like such a big pain point. And we did that in the first batch of FPV gates. Actually, the supplier switched the material from what we tested to the first batch. So they had a ton of issues. They were not that strong. Mm-hmm. So we ended up doing, like, we replaced all of them from the first batch. Anyone who told us like, hey, I have an issue with V1, we replaced them all, which was a great lesson in like making people happy and serving your customer, because I had people who were just so upset and totally reasonable. Like they were so upset and I just messaged them and be like, hey man, like this is what happened. We would love to replace them. And then they became very loyal customers because we had that conversation. And so now I have people who are like such a big fan of the brand who are originally so angry because we just had that conversation with them. So very, very important lessons in there.
Yeah. Did you end up building that? Like it looks like it's a standalone, really successful, like it's just operating on its own right now.
So it's run by Silas Propsicle. He's a pilot. And he runs the like day to day. We have a few products that are kind of like our staples. We made a new, actually a new version of the practice gate, which is like the pop-up gate.
Like 3 months ago.
Yeah. It wasn't too long ago. So it's running, it's great. I don't spend that much time on it. It's kind of a fun thing to like jump back into occasionally. But yeah, it's cool that like people get enduring value out of it. Like even the past week, I've seen a bunch of orders come in and it's just like people buying gates or frames or whatever they already had. And it's not my focus at all, but it does still serve the community, which I like.
You said, I think right after high school, you had a moment of weakness and you considered becoming, doing CS. Tell me about that and why you decided to say no.
Yeah, I think I was pretty, that was like a pretty lost period of my life. It wasn't very long, but I was starting to get interested in programming just for the like utility that it had other places. And I knew a couple of my friends who went off and did CS. So I was talking to them and it seemed like maybe an interesting thing to do. And I wasn't really sure part of it was like I had very low conviction in any college that I wanted to go to. But it was sort of the expectation. And I also think I thought that if I did CS, I'd probably be able to keep running companies and doing drone racing through college, versus like aerospace engineering, which I didn't think I'd be able to do that. And I was pretty focused on, or I was like pretty excited about all the things I was working on outside of academics. But now like if I was to go back to school, it would absolutely be aerospace engineering. And like that's
wait, so tell me about that, because I haven't heard anything about aerospace engineering before.
Aerospace engineering is much more core to who I am. Mm-hmm. It's like based on everything we've talked about, I think, you know, you can see that, right? But there's a lot of things you don't learn by putting foam airplanes together. It would be really, really awesome to have a deeper level of understanding and go through like the real math and academics behind aerospace.
Okay.
So, you know, I'm not planning to go back to school, obviously, but that would be what I would pick if I had to pick something.
What was it like to go from being, you know, not even qualifying for nationals to literally winning, I think, like the world championships in like 2020? What was that process and what happened afterwards?
Yeah, so it was the like big step of getting into professional racing was going from, you know, not qualifying, getting third at nationals, then racing with Team USA on DCL. DCL was a very tough season for us. We had a lot of gear issues. We didn't perform that well because we didn't have very much stuff to practice with. A lot of the time we like showed up to events and our drones just like wouldn't fly. It was very, very strange. There was a lot of weird stuff that happened that season. And we actually experienced the first time I'd ever seen like electronic warfare done was at a DCL race, which we could talk about. But yeah, DCL was a really tough season, but it was very fun to be able to travel and compete at a high level when the drones worked. And Switzerland went quite well. I think we got second the first event, and I flew very well there. And then it was just like all downhill for the rest of the season. So it was pretty tough. And then Korea went quite well. We got third as a team, which I think we could have done better, actually. But I got third individually, which I was very happy with. And so there was a lot of ups and downs in that 2019 season. And then 2019 Nationals was terrible for me.
Really?
I went from getting third to getting like 26th or something. I had gear issue. I showed up the first day, my controller broke. Just literally like equivalent of blue screen of death on a controller, just stopped working. Texted the team manager. He overnighted me a new radio, but these radios, the like feel from of the gimbals from radio to radio was drastically different. And so it was like switching to an entire new setup, and I was using someone else's radio in the interim. So it was just like my beloved consistency got killed. And then I think I got mid-aired in like most of my qualifying runs. And then I had one amazing run. And then on the last lap, my drone just like fell out of the sky for no reason. So I started low in brackets, and I just like I was not in the flow state at all during brackets, and then got mid-aired out on the final one. So that was just a really like rough event. And I went, you know, third to 26th. And then I felt like I needed to do something the next year. And 2020, I did a lot of simulator racing because COVID started. Did a lot of simulator racing. Took some time to do things outside of drone racing for the first time in my adolescence. I had like figured out that there was like cars and people and like just like other things outside of drones. But before, as we were coming up on Champs, and it had turned to like a global event at this point because there was a global qualifier. And I just remember like having this moment of like, I am going to put everything that I have into this to prepare and do as well as I can. And I was like, my absolute goal, I was thinking about this like 2 months out from the end, I was like, my absolute goal here is to win. There's nothing else. And I invited David to come practice with me in Vermont, and basically took those 2 months essentially off of school. And David, I think, was on a gap year at that point. So we just fly every single day for like 2 months. And that was my only goal. It was just like, this was going to be my like absolute peak performance event.
I heard you say that you said that you really liked consistency. How did you manage to make your quadcopter better while also like training enough on it so that you can get comfortable?
Good question. Great question, because there was this sort of like component selection process that I was going through pretty like up until the event, or up until like 2 weeks before the event. I was still picking between two very core components, like which one I was going to use, and they you know, make the drone fly completely differently. And I set a like deadline of when I was going to pick by so that I would have enough time to get fully adjusted to one of them. But I also just flew both of them enough where I could kind of switch between. But it was a huge thing on my mind, because I was like, I need to lock everything in by this date so that I can only fly one setup going into the event. And that was really important. And then just those were like my most beautiful drone builds, I think, ever, were the builds that I made for before 2020 Champs. And there's just so much care in every single thing that went into those builds.
How many parts did like a quadcopter have that you could customize?
There actually, a lot of it was like component selection rather than customization. You know, I've done a lot of things with frames, and you know, Olaf had worked on flight controllers, and we were going back and forth on how to make kind of better boards that would connect everything, like mounting boards, right? And then there was a lot of customization you could do in the flight control firmware. But it was selecting like what I thought the best combination of stuff was. So the big ones are propellers, motors, frames, flight controller. At the time, it was picking between Flight 1 and Beta Flight, which is a big debate. Electronic speed controller, the motor driver, and then your like camera matters, but not in the same like flight performance sense. And video transmitter just needs to be reliable, good antennas for that. So those are the main components, and you're basically picking everything that you think is best and suits your style the best.
So between like 2020 and 2022, I did see that you also competed in a few other events, but did you also, before founding Neuros, did you create any other companies?
So I worked on a, after DRL, mm-hmm. I'd done a season of DRL, was not a big fan of simulator racing. The live events were very fun. Especially like our final race in Vegas with a crowd, I loved because it was the pressure of the crowd. It was like what drone racing is supposed to be. Live event with a crowd at a cool location. But we had one race like that the entire year. Everything else was either pre-filming at a stadium and you do like four levels back to back, or on the simulator. I just hated the simulator. It was like not, like drone racing is already part video game. Don't make it an entire video. No one wants to watch that. So I felt like I'd done everything I wanted to do in drone racing, truthfully, as a pilot. And so I was looking more at the startup side of things and kind of looking for something to do, also looking for an excuse to take another gap year. And a friend of mine was started working on this venture fund. I thought it was really interesting. It was only on hard tech, very early, thinking about like the best ways to incubate companies and fund very early ideas, scientists, technologists. So I got pretty interested in this and worked on it for about a year before kind of having the realization like wasn't the perfect fit for me. I wanted to build hardware. There was other things out there, but it was really, really useful to do that. And it was the sort of bridge between drone racing and founding Neuros.
What was the like first 2 months? Because I know that you said that you basically had, I mean, you wanted to raise like $1 million or something before Olaf would decide to fully join you. What did the first like 2 months of Neuros look like?
Even more than 2 months, like I actually were about to be at the 1 year mark of there was this one night where I could not sleep. I was just lying in my bed thinking about this idea around kind of the first product that I was designing, what a company in this space would look like, how it would be different. This is actually March 10th of 2023 when I couldn't sleep because I was thinking about this thing. And I'd already been exploring it, but that was this like very clear date in my mind. And so I think that's when I was just doing the formative work, trying to figure out what does a defense startup look like. It was just so many things to learn. And then I incorporated kind of end of April and was talking to Olaf about this idea and trying to, you know, get him really excited about it and trying to get him to help on it. And then got serious about raising the pre-seed after I had taken a trip to Alaska and had actually started working. I was like working very hard on the pitch deck and working with some like initial end user feedback of that went into what is now the first product. And then I was like, okay, it's time to raise. And I'd only talked to like two investors before that. And it was just, I set this bar where I knew I needed to raise, like $1 million, to get this thing going. And that was the bar where like Olaf would be fully in and I could just pursue it with everything I had. And that's what I wanted to do.
I know that you initially didn't think that storytelling was a whole, like it wasn't super important. I think that you initially were just like focused on completely building products. When did you decide to make the transition to kind of learning how to tell the story?
Yeah, I'd had that foray into sort of like the branding marketing thing. And I was running a D2C business. So I understood that part of it, but it wasn't storytelling in the same way I think about it now. And it wasn't just it wasn't something that occupied a lot of my brain space and that I'd practiced a lot. And now I've said like new technology is basically new technology is basically useless without good storytelling. Or the inverse, which is like new technology can be completely ruined by bad narrative. And just like look at nuclear power, for example. But I started realizing, you know, one of the most important things I'm going to have to be able to do is explain my idea in a very like quick, digestible, but also in-depth way. And also encode like, this is who I am. This is why I care about it. And this is why I'm the right person to do it. And here's where it can go in the future. And it's just like this, all of these things that need to be encoded into a relatively short period of time when you're, you know, talking to an investor or whoever it is for the first time. So that became something I, you know, started thinking about a lot. And I also just started meeting a lot of like great storytellers and seeing how they did it. And now I think it's, you know, it's absolutely critical for good founders. Like if you want to be able to fund and sell and rally support and get talent for your idea, like that is core.
Do you have any interesting stories about like the history of this industry that you've just learned about?
I mean, I'm very, very inspired by the stories that are, you know, that came out of Skunk Works about building the first fighter jet in America in such a ridiculously short period of time, like roughly 150 days from nothing to working fighter jet. And the process that went in behind the U-2 and then eventually the F-117 and the Blackbird. And like those were all of the most revolutionary aircraft in history, all built by this team that like figured out the process for incredible R&D. And thinking about like the Blackbird specifically, it's such a ridiculous stack of enabling technologies that were, that lined up, like that were basically invented around that airplane. It wasn't like one singular hard technical challenge. It was many hard technical challenges that all lined up to make this thing possible and done by a very small team very quickly. So that's incredibly inspiring. I think a lot of people look to that now in aerospace, but you know, I'm similar in that sense. And then just like, it, what is also talked about now pretty broadly, but is still not taken seriously in my opinion, is just the level of production that actually happens and needs to happen in a full-scale conflict or to deter a full-scale conflict. And you look at World War II and how we had worse tanks than the Germans and they built, or we, but we just built more and like that ended up being the right solution. There's a big lesson there. And industrial waste is something that we've really, really messed up on in this country now. And yeah, I think like that's where the most important, exciting, and also challenging opportunities lie.
Did you take any examples from them building the Blackbird and whatever in, like you said, 150 days?
Not the Blackbird, but the first fighter jet in America, yeah.
Did you take any examples for like team building or learnings from that?
A lot of it is like keeping a very small elite team and seeing how hard you can push with that. Like it's funny, the companies that don't accomplish that much, in my opinion, like big tech companies, they tend to get incredibly overinflated. Like people with all of these sort of abstracted and unimportant jobs, because they don't have this really important goal that they're working towards. And you like, there is a limit to a number of people you can rally around a really important goal and like have actual output coming out of everyone, right? So I think maintaining a small team, especially on engineering, is important. And you can kind of look to what's possible from Skunk Works. I think, like, I don't think anyone's operating at that level anymore.
So you're setting up your manufacturing in the United States, which is somewhat, it's less rare for like a startup to do, but it's very rare, I think, for is it less rare for like defense tech startups or just defense companies in general?
Defense companies in general, like your manufacturing usually has to be domestic. The problem is there's a lot of like the supply chain is not looked into very deeply in many cases. So there's a lot of things that actually rely on Chinese components that are kind of passed off as fully US there's very questionable practices within the defense supply chain.
What's the most challenging thing that you've dealt with so far with actually like trying to manufacture here in El Segundo?
Broadly, we run into the problem that we don't have a lot of skilled labor in this stuff. In LA, there is a decent number of good technicians, right? There's a lot of aerospace companies and there are people here, but it's all in comparison to China. And if you compare to China, like, we're in such a bad position when it comes to the skill of labor, I guess the cost of labor, but it's honestly, it's mostly about like the skill, the availability, and how, like, how much resistance is there in trying to set up, say, like an electronics production line. The difference between doing that in the United States and doing that in Shenzhen is just orders of magnitude different in like getting people who know how to solder, getting people who know how to set up SMT machines and run an SMT line, who will very carefully check every single board that comes off of that line and like not cut any corners. That stuff is inherent in Shenzhen. And if you need some component or machine or anything, you like go to the local electronics market and you have it available to you. And we don't have that here. So it's like working with what we've got.
Yeah. Do you admire anything about China right now that the US doesn't have?
I admire that a lot of people in China spend their day making physical things and have an appreciation for that and learn the skills behind that. There's also like, you know, bad reasons why that's the case. And there's very questionable working conditions in many of these places. And like a lot of things I do not look up to, but just the like, personal responsibility behind making a product and the skilled labor that goes into making a product is very, very impressive.
So when you first founded Neuros, you flew to another country. What was that experience like?
Yeah, basically, like from day one, we've always been optimizing around what is useful quickly, what is the experience of the end user, how can we build a better product around that? That was the first thing we did. Me and Olaf, like, was talking to end users and figuring out how does our basically like almost 10 years of experience building drones, how does that translate into this defense application? So there's a lot of things to figure out there, but it all came through like talking to the end users and then the people who made the acquisitions decisions. What did they index on and what was useful? So we started talking to multiple different groups and then decided to actually make something happen, we needed to build drones and fly with them to like places where drones are being used and talk to those people. And you know, outside of the United States and inside of the United States too, but like outside of the United States, we needed to go and just have the face-to-face conversations. Face-to-face conversations is you can't
incredibly
replace
powerful.
It. Yeah, you can't replace it.
Yeah. How do you be like customer obsessed in a business like this?
There's multiple groups that you have to please when you're building a defense company. You, like, first and foremost, in my opinion, need to care about your end user, but your end user doesn't usually make the decision of what's being bought. I think it's just about having empathy for the people that are going to be using your product. And it's usually, depends on who you're selling to, but there can be a very wide range of people from like different experience levels, different backgrounds who are going to be using your product. But having empathy for those people and like, this is why the details matter. This is why what we ship, what goes out the door matters. There can't be issues because if there's issues, it puts someone's life at risk. And the cognitive load that they're under already, like they don't need to pull something out of the box and have there be like a bug or an issue, or especially when you're deploying to real places and not just doing testing or demos. And it you should start with testing and demos, and
you need to be able to count on this.
Yeah. Like if you're building something that someone's counting on, like you absolutely can't mess up in that regard. And if you're not there yet, like you just be very honest, right? Like this is a first prototype. This may have issues. This probably will have issues. Please tell me what they are. And they will do their own calculation of like, are we in a place to test a prototype or not? But I would say like there are groups that you can't really mess up with.
Yeah.
And reputation is everything. And so you, if you're giving a product that's a prototype level product, you have to be completely honest about that and not expect more out of that than you should.
Between flying to another country and actually deciding A, what your first product was, and like going through the iterative process of like building it, what was that like?
We were basically just chasing people down through Signal chats, and I finally got some people on the phone and got this like information dump of what was going on with FPV drones, and also like ideas for future platforms. And we had our own, and I think that's really important that like we have our own vision of what we think is useful, and you're kind of tying that like, I guess, like technologist opinion with end user feedback and finding the middle ground that ends up making a useful but also innovative thing. But yeah, we got hardware out the door really fast. A lot of that was enabled by having built similar stuff for a very long time. And we've gone through a lot of iteration on the product based on real world feedback. And that has been the most important factor in building a good product, is testing it with a real end user and just quickly implementing those changes. And sometimes they're very small and sometimes they're very large, but just having the flexibility as a company to, and like the mindset where someone will tell you like, this is awful. Like this part of your product is awful. You have to change it. And sometimes it's something you're attached to and you just have to be okay with that. And that's a process that we've learned and is really important.
Do you have any stories or examples of things that you initially really wanted to include but had to decide to take out or change?
Slight spin on that is just learning how hard it is to build a like new hardware product and all the complexity behind that and everything you have to coordinate and test. And I'd say there's a lot of things we wanted to do too quickly that we learned will take more time, but they will be much better once we've taken that time. So being okay with that and balancing that with like being a company that, in my opinion, you know, executes very fast with having these broader goals and sort of like harder technological challenges that we're working towards over a longer period of time.
So you're building just drones right now. How long do you think it's going to be until you decide to work on another platform?
Drones can mean a lot of different things. So we might be building like drones for a very long time. They just may look different than the ones that we build right now. I can say like our focus is unmanned defense systems. Mm-hmm. And anything in that category that can be mass manufactured or that benefits from being mass manufactured and we can have like a really useful take on is within our scope.
How do you think about like spinning up a factory extremely quickly to, you know, going from a completely empty warehouse that is here to something that's producing, you know, 10,000 drones a month?
You have to start with the like very basic process of, you know, how much time does it take one person to screw together this entire assembly? Then how do you break it down into steps? Then eventually, do you want to automate those steps? How can you automate those steps? How do you redesign the product around automation, assembly line? There's so much there. Like we could spend an hour talking about how you design a product around manufacturing and how you try and do it quickly. But right now it feels like we've set very aggressive targets for where we want to be at in terms of production. We think that hitting those targets is key for a lot of different aspects of the company. And so it's basically our sole focus is like building that production. And it's a very different problem than most like hard tech startups start with, which is building one thing that kind of works. And it usually takes a long time. We have something that works. Now we want to build a lot of them. So it's a very different structure than what a lot of people deal with.
Do you have any role models for people that, like, I know that Elon has done this with like Model 3s and stuff, but do you have any role models for people that have like scaled up production really quickly?
Yeah, they're like manufacturing is not a lost art in America. It's just becoming a lost art. Mm. We still have a, you know, by dollars, massive manufacturing industry. It's just there's a very big concern about a lot of these things going away. And in things like consumer electronics, like that's where China is just so much better than us. Elon is a pretty obvious but great example. And I would actually say maybe looking more at SpaceX in some ways, because they took something that is ridiculously expensive, they simplified it aggressively, they vertically integrated the manufacturing, and then they changed the game. And I think like no one's actually done that in defense. No one has built a company that is truly vertically integrated, that really reduces cost by an order of magnitude. No one's built the SpaceX of defense. So that's a pretty interesting one to look at. But obviously with Tesla as well, like they've gone through manufacturing hell. And now they're like world class. So it's very inspiring to look at things like that.
So I imagine that you've probably been like inspired by an author or something. Who's that person for you? And what kind of like future are you excited to be building?
I'm a little bit different than I think a lot of deep tech founders, where I wasn't super into sci-fi. Mm-hmm. I do like sci-fi, but I can't pick out like one that is incredibly impactful to me, because I think I have always had a really deep appreciation for the things we already have or had. And it's the things that we had that we don't anymore that kind of really make me sad. So like, you know, the best defense industrial base in the world, the ability to make humans travel supersonically, having that widely available, like those are the things that I look at right now as being the most important to like get back to. I will say one of my like favorite characters is definitely Iron Man. That's been a long time. Like Tony Stark is amazing. Eventually I will build an Iron Man suit, and we can look back at this in like 20 years and see how that works out, but I will do it. So I could say that, but not for any like kind of broader civilization reason. It's just like, I think he's an amazing character.
Did you ever try to design a like jetpack in real life? You did.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
What's the story behind that?
It was like the same thing as like personal flying device that I was trying to do. Thought about the Iron Man suit thing, designed like the palm thrusters, would have made like a pound of thrust looking back, but you know, designed the like turbine that would sit here, intake air from the sides. And I thought about that a lot. Looked at the, something people should look up if they've never seen it is Jetman. He literally flies around on a carbon fiber wing with four RC jet engines. It is actually a jetpack. Like we have that. That does exist. It's just incredibly dangerous. So things like that have always been amazing to me. Like I want to build that for fun eventually.
I think final question, what's the hardest thing you've overcome?
Something that was very, very difficult for me was when my family moved from Alaska to the East Coast, to New Hampshire. In Alaska, I like absolutely adored where I lived. It was incredibly special to me. I'd moved to a new school 2 years before and felt like I had this incredible friend group that I was building there. And then my best friend David was also then going to that school. And it was like, I felt incredibly at home there, and it sort of had like everything I wanted. And then my family made this decision to move to New Hampshire. And I didn't really have any say in it. And I was just extremely against it. I think for about a year after we moved, I was like very, very unhappy. Like on a day-to-day basis, I was incredibly unhappy. Looking back, like it did allow me to have more access to drone racing, like I don't think I would have done what I did in drone racing if we had not have moved. And I think there's a lot of things that can be attributed to like moving to somewhere with better access. But it was a total shift in my life, and it was very, very upsetting, especially at that age. And I think it's still something like I think back on a lot, and I go back and like see my friends in Alaska that are, I still have some, you know, really close friends there. My best friend, a few other people, go back and visit them and like see how they, you know, went to high school and kind of grew up in Alaska all the way. And I get pretty sad that I didn't have that, with those people who are still very, very special to me. But yeah, I think like it was definitely a positive in my life, for the trajectory I'm on now, but it's something I still feel.
What eventually got you out of feeling just very down for that first year?
I think I found my own thing, which was drone racing. And I didn't really have a incredible friend group at school. I wasn't interested in like playing lacrosse or like optimizing for SATs or any of the things that my, you know, that Hanover, New Hampshire optimizes for. I didn't care about any of that, but I did have drone racing and I had better access to drone racing. And I just like went all in on that. And I made an incredible friend group in that as well. And now I have like these people who are very important to me. They live all across the country, and we basically lived on Discord together. So like Discord, and then eventually video games became a way of like staying connected to those people. I've spent maybe 10,000 hours of my life on Discord with people.
10,000 hours.
Probably, I would guess. It was like every day working on drones, flying, playing video games after it got dark with the same group of people on Discord. So probably 10,000 hours.
That's wild. Well, thank you, Soren, for coming on.
Thank you. This was amazing. Sure.